From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Today we look at Trickster. The Paiute Indians of Nevada introduce a young anthropologist to their spirit creature, the mischievous trickster, Coyote. Also, we'll learn about the literary tricksterism of Carlos Castaneda, the author of such bestsellers as The Teachings of Don Juan, A Yaqui Way of Knowledge. And we'll explore the films of the prankster mythmakers, Ethan and Joel Cohen. But first, Lewis Hyde. David Foster Wallace described Hyde as one of our true superstars of nonfiction. Hyde's the author of the critically acclaimed book Trickster Makes This World, Mischief, Myth, and Art. In the book, Hyde explores the cultural history of such infamous trickster figures as Loki and Monkey. He told Steve Paulson the meaning of the word trickster.
The sort of thumbnail definition of these characters is that they are the sacred boundary crossers. So to unpack that a little bit, first of all human societies have a sense of the boundaries, both internal and external. Internally, for example, male and female, up and down, heaven and hell, night and day, right and wrong, dirty and clean. You know, there are all these distinctions that help us organize a world. And then we also have some sense of the edge of our world, that this is our community and there may be other people over the hill, but that's their community. So this is, in a way, how you set up a cosmology. You have an organized world because you know where the boundaries are. It turns out that that is not enough to organize your world. Interesting fact in the Greek mythologies is that there are 12 gods. So it's as if each of them has a world, has a piece of the world and some boundaries. And Hermes, who is the sacred boundary crosser in that world, comes along 12th. The implication being that you don't really get the world lively until you have somebody who can break the boundaries, who can cross them even though we take them seriously.
What does Hermes do as a trickster? How does he cross those boundaries?
Well, one of them simply is Hermes takes souls into the underworld and can bring them back. He brings Persephone back from the underworld after she's been captured by Pluto. So that's a serious boundary between life and death. Normally, those of us who go to the underworld do not come back. Death is a final thing. So in this mythology, it's imagined that there is a character who can move back and forth across the boundary between life and death. And similarly, Hermes is the messenger of the gods. So we have a clear boundary between what's divine and what's human. And yet we need some commerce between these two worlds. And Hermes is the character who knows how to conduct that commerce. The same with Coyote. The Coyote figure, in a way, the Coyote figure brings death into being and then is able to travel into the other world. Apparently, it used to be that people came back from the underworld and Coyote screwed things up so horribly that now when people die, they don't come back. If there are not enough boundaries around, the trickster figure will create them so that then later he can have a job traveling back and forth.
And it's worth pointing out that these tricksters often generate a lot of anger, resentment. I mean, the other gods don't always like what Hermes does. And maybe even a more pronounced example of that is Loki in Norse legends. I mean, those guys were furious at Loki.
In a certain way, none of us like to have these guys around because they break up the ordered world that we care about. Though the flip side of that is if you don't have them around, it turns out the ordered world begins to grow brittle and stale. The Loki story, yeah. There was a character named Balder who had been told he would never die, and Loki ends up figuring out a way to kill him. It's another story really about a trickster creating death. So here's a character who should never die, and Loki says, you know, that kind of perfection irritates me. The world as human beings are going to know it isn't perfect in that way. And so Loki figures out a way for Baldur to be killed. And then, yes, the gods become so angry at this that they trap Loki and they tie him under the world. And then what happens in the sequence of the Norse sagas is that actually then the world comes to an end. We get Ragnarok, the doom of the gods, and everything falls apart. The implication being that on the one hand, these characters are very irritating to have around, and yet if you suppress them totally, it would be even worse. And, you know, my book is partly then about imagination itself, the disruptive imagination that is part of all artistic process and that unsettles our worlds. And then the question, how do we relate to it? And in this case, the lesson would be, well, the one thing you should certainly not do is to suppress it entirely.
Hmm. Part of the reason why people don't like a trickster figure like Loki is that he seems to operate without any moral rules. I mean, he lies, among other things, and most of us think that society needs a clear moral structure.
Societies do need a clear moral structure. And the puzzle is that sometimes our moral structures wear out on us, that sometimes the rules need to change. Sometimes sexual mores change as the centuries go by, or the relationship between African Americans and white folks change as the centuries go by. So you need a character around who is not immoral, that is to say, this is not a devil character, this is not somebody who's out to do evil, but amoral, a character who is not so conscious of the current morality and is able, therefore, to suggest other ways to operate. I'll give you a quick example. I speak in the book about Maxine Hong Kingston, whose parents were Chinese immigrants to America, who tried to maintain the moral structure of a Chinese village in their home in Stockton, California. And poor young Maxine is sent to the local public school where there's a whole different set of rules. And part of her struggle to become a citizen of this country and a writer was to figure out what the rules should be and to shape a new set of rules that really fit the immigrant experience that she had had. And she then is interested in the Chinese trickster figure who's called Monkey. And in the famous stories about Monkey, he helps a Buddhist monk move from China to India to get the scriptures and back. And he's useful on that journey because the Buddhist monk, of course, has a moral code, but therefore is kind of witless in certain situations. And Monkey is able, being an amoral character, to help the trip continue.
And part of your point here is that it's often the artist who is the trickster in society, certainly in our society today. And, well, Pablo Picasso said at one point, art is a lie that makes us realize truth. That's really what you're talking about, creative deception in a way to get to a larger, maybe a bigger truth.
Yes. You know, the story that I hold up against this out of the trickster mythologies is one about Krishna in the Hindu stories. As a little baby, he is a thief of butter. His mother is a milkmaid they have butter in the house. And every time she goes out, she says, don't steal the butter, Krishna. And then she goes out and he does, of course, break open the pots and smear the butter all over his face. And she comes home and he always lies to her. And one of his lies is, I didn't steal the butter. I had a sore on my wrist and I was just trying to soothe it. Or the one that I like best is when he says, well, how could I steal the butter, Mother? Doesn't everything in the house belong to us?
Hmm.
And now what he's doing is calling into question the rules that she has made up to organize her world and his world and to say, you know, there are other sets of rules. In that story, partly what's going on is Krishna is a divinity and everything belongs to the divinity. God can probably not steal anything because everything belongs to God. So he's saying, sure, you have local patterns that help you organize your life, but sometimes you need to step back and look at the world from this wider perspective. In terms of art, you know, my point in the book is not that artists are tricksters, but that the trickster mythology is a useful set of stories to hold up against some artistic practice. And so, for example, what I do with Maxine Hong Kingston is to say, look, this immigrant narrative seems to require a certain shamelessness on Kingston's part. With Picasso, you can do the same thing. Picasso, yes, he says that artists are able to tell lies that convince us they are truths. And in a certain way, that's what you see that he did in his life. He began to change the way we see the world. We see it differently now. It seems true in Picasso's sense, whereas when he first began, people thought this is nuts.
Well, let me mention another artist, maybe a more obvious trickster, Marcel Duchamp, who, of course, famously put a urinal in an art show and called it art. You draw some analogies between Marcel Duchamp and Ishu, the trickster god of the Yoruba people of Nigeria.
Yes. So Duchamp and others in this century have been interested in chance as a tool in artistic practice. And Ishu in Yoruba mythology is a god of the crossroads. You run across him as you're out in the middle of no place where the road to one town crosses the road to another. And this is where accidental things happen, where chance events happen, where stuff you could not have predicted falls upon you. And so I believe that the tricksters are partly – the stories are partly a way to explain chance events, and that then it helps us illuminate why artistic practice might engage with chance. To think about Duchamp in these terms, he was interested in forgetting the hand, by which he meant – you look at, say, an artist like Cézanne. You can see a Cézanne painting as a Cézanne painting even if you don't know that – you haven't looked at the label – because he has a style. And Duchamp was interested, how could you get out of your own style? How could you leave your own personality? How could you make something that didn't bear the mark of your history and your training and your habits? And he got interested in chance on those terms. It begins to inject something into the art which you could not have predicted knowing who you were to begin with.
Now, you draw in some surprising figures in your cultural history of tricksters. One is Frederick Douglass, the ex-slave who went on to write famous narratives about his experience as a slave, became the most famous black person in America. How is he a trickster?
You know, I got into this because there's the old stories about Hermes. Hermes' father was Zeus and his mother was a shamefaced nymph named Maia. And I read the story as Hermes trying to figure out how to get himself a place in the Olympic pantheon. And I kept thinking about Frederick Douglass in this same way, because Douglass's father was the slave owner, a white guy who has a slave in the eastern shore of Maryland, and his mother was a black slave woman. Just the beginning of the story raises all kinds of interesting questions. How do we sort such a person who has a white father and a black mother? In American ideology, we call that person black, but logically it's nuts. And logically American racism is nuts. And Douglass himself felt this. So the line of analysis is that Douglass appears writing his narrative of his life as an act of intervention, like the trickster's acts of intervention. He puts himself in the seam between the divisions that made plantation culture work. Not just black and white, but along with that went a whole other set of dualities, including literacy and illiteracy, animality and humanness, and so forth. And Douglass essentially comes forward saying, you know, go on, figure out where to put me. And he doesn't fit, particularly because he's able to write a narrative. If he's going to be black, he should be illiterate. If he's literate, he shouldn't be black. It makes the whole thing a puzzle. And so Douglass appears as the kind of trickster who actually doesn't just make a culture lively, he actually destroys it. He and a whole other set of people called the abolitionists destroyed plantation culture as it was constituted in the early 19th century and gave us a new world that follows the Civil War.
And he partly destroyed it by stealing the gift of literacy. I mean, it's worth pointing out that it was illegal to teach slaves to read, and his master, his father, didn't want him to do that, but he kind of snuck around corners to figure out how to read and write.
It'd be a good example of the point we were making earlier about morality. It was immoral as well as illegal to teach a slave to read in the plantation South, and a woman slave owner in Baltimore didn't understand this and started to teach Douglass to read. And the master was so upset by this that they stopped. But Douglass then immediately saw, oh, this is where the treasure lies. I don't know what it is. And he then began to teach himself to read. And yes, he stole literacy. And in doing so, he stole the tradition that was embodied in that literacy. So he got a hold of a book called The Columbian Orator that had in it a dialogue between a slave owner and a free slave that argued against slavery. And Douglass was astounded by this. He'd never heard these arguments. And, you know, he essentially absorbed the Enlightenment tradition from Europe and brought it to bear against the world he'd been brought up with and used it as a weapon against that world.
Hmm. So this theft of literacy was an act of creation as well. I mean, a creation that destroyed.
Yep. So you could say, again, almost it goes back to that story about Krishna stealing butter. Doesn't literacy belong to everybody? That is to say, Or right now in this culture, we're having a big argument about piracy of things on the internet and so forth. Whenever these questions about theft arise, in the background is a question of, so who made up these rules and what do the rules serve and are they still serving as fully and as usefully as they are meant to do?
Lewis Hyde is the author of Trickster Makes This World, Mischief, Myth, and Art. He spoke with Steve Paulson. What do you think of Hyde's ideas about tricksters? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find links to Lewis Hyde's website and our Facebook page. Coming up, a young anthropologist is introduced to the rule-breaking trickster Coyote and Carlos Castaneda's dark legacy as we continue our hour on Trickster. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Eileen Kane is the author of Trickster, an anthropological memoir. In the book, Kane revisits her experience as a young, newly married, trainee anthropologist studying the Paiute Indians of Nevada. The year was 1964. Kane wanted to find out more about a local man named Jack Wilson, alias Wovoka.
Wovoka was the founder of the Ghost Dance. He was sometimes described as an Indian messiah, although I don't think the Paiutes described him that way. He was a healer, an informal leader, and he developed this movement, which was a very peaceable movement, and he said that if the Indians didn't lie or cheat or drink and lived a good life, that all the dead Indians and the dead animals would come back and they would live as they did in the past, and the white people would simply go someplace else. They wouldn't be hurt. They would just go someplace else and they'd be happy themselves. And that people should perform this traditional circle dance, which he associated with his movement. So that's how it came to be called the Ghost Dance. The dead Indians would come back. It had a big historical impact, even though he came from this tiny place, because it spread over the whole western half of the United States. And it was actually a critical factor leading up to the Battle of Wounded Knee, because the Sioux took it up, and the U.S. government misinterpreted what they were doing. They thought they were doing some kind of a war dance or preparation for war, when in fact they were practicing the Ghost Dance.
How often in history do we find a peace dance misinterpreted as a war dance? More often, I suppose, than we wish.
More often, I think, maybe, than we think.
Yeah. What's fascinating in a way is that he was already gone 30 years by the time you got to the Paiute Nation, but he was still, among a part of the nation anyway, still well known.
The Paiutes were living in difficult circumstances at that time, so he wasn't as well known then as he is today. But they certainly remembered him. Some people actually knew him. He died in 1932, and before he died, he told them to take up another religion while he was gone, that he was coming back. So my neat little project was that I was going to study what religion they took up. And I thought I would find these nice parallels between the Ghost Dance and the new religion. And I could just see these articles, you know, that I would publish, as Kane says in her seminal work. And, you know, no one has refuted the analysis of Kane and so forth. So I had stars in my eyes over this whole thing.
Well, one of the things that they introduced you to that we've heard things about that are fascinating is the coyote, the trickster figure in what we call Native American myth. I don't know what they call it. What did they tell you about Coyote?
What they told me was that I couldn't understand Coyote unless I understood Wolf. Now, at this point, incidentally, they had hijacked my research. So I should go back just for a second. When I got out there, I had thought of myself, I would be the expert, as anthropologists presented themselves in those days, and they would be the subject. And they took one look at me and they said, oh, we're going to be the parents. And they were extremely worried on two counts. One was that my husband was lonely and I should go back to him as soon as possible. And the second was, if I didn't get a good grade on my report, if I got a poor mark, would they be seen as failed Indians? So they weren't that enthusiastic about my Wovoka project because he still wasn't a huge figure to them. There were people who still remembered him as a real human being. And secondly, they thought all I had to do was go down to the Assembly of God minister at the end of the colony. He'd been allowed to establish a little church there, and a few people were going there. And I could ask him in about 20 minutes, why had people joined his religion, and I could go home again. So I said, no, I have to be here for the whole summer. So that's when they started talking to me about Wolf and Coyote. They explained that Wolf is a straight arrow. He is the creator. He created a perfect world, very orderly. He's a noble character, wise, precise, and he just has created this beautiful, orderly world. The reason we don't see much of this beautiful, orderly world today is because of Coyote. Coyote was his mischievous little brother, and Coyote was not perfect. He was far from perfect. Like all of us, he had these contradictory characteristics. He was a sly innocent. He was a wise fool. He was a sacred sinner. He had this enormous sexual appetite, and he was always starving. And he was functioning in Wolf's world, which was perfect, which he was not. And he didn't manage very well. So he was always running after Wolf saying, brother, help me. Show me how to do this. Give me that. And Wolf almost always refused because every time he helped Coyote, it blew up in his face. It disturbed the order of his and the perfection of his universe. But sometimes he did help. And for example, Coyote came to him once and said, I know you keep all the animals in a hole in the ground and you take one out when you're hungry. And I want to do that too. Could I do that? And Wolf finally said, yes, okay, you can have one. Take one. Put the lid back on. Naturally, of course, Coyote left the lid off, and all the animals escaped and ran in every direction. This is why the Indians had to hunt rather than just have their food handy, as Wolf had. Coyote helps to explain why the world is the way it is today.
I can see why Coyote is such an appealing figure, and not just in mythology. People like the idea. At the same time, they're angry. I mean, it is your mischievous little brother, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
He drives you crazy, but you love him to death.
Yes. And he was important to the Paiute people because he lived in a world not of his own making. And he scrambled around to do the best he could to meet the needs that he had. And basically, it reflected their own lives. Yeah. They were living on this reservation. They could see the local school, but some years before I arrived, they were still in a situation where they couldn't go to that local school. They had to send their children to so-called Indian schools hundreds of miles away. Sometimes the kids would be gone for just a year, but sometimes they'd be gone for years and years. They weren't allowed into the places of entertainment, the shops. They worked for less than minimum wage. So they were scrambling around in a world not of their making.
Yeah, I can see what you meant now in the book you wrote. Coyote tells you more about the teller than the tale. That's what they told you, the Paiute.
That's why they were telling me. Coyote has many, many functions. Tricksters have many functions. But they were telling me this aspect of Coyote because of that very fact. He did reflect the kind of finagling and dodges that they had to get up to live in this world that they hadn't created and in which they had no power.
Yeah. Did you begin to see early on the parallels? I mean, the trickster figure, Coyote, actually helped you see the parallels between the Paiute community and Yerington and your own hometown. But did that happen right away, or was that a slow process?
It was a slow process. My mother started sending me letters, and I'd say every second or third day I got a letter from her. She originally started sending me postcards addressed to, Running Water and Sitting Pretty and things like that. And I said, no, please stop that. So she started sending me letters, and she sent me news about Youngstown. But she'd also send me accounts of who'd been knocked off by the mafia. Youngstown at that time it had just been written up in the Saturday Evening Post right before I went to Yerington as Murder Town USA. And there were many stories about it being Bomb City, the murder capital of the United States. We were quite notorious at the time. And so she'd be sending me these accounts of who had knocked off whom and so forth. And the Paiutes, incidentally, became fascinated by this. They would hang around the post office waiting to get my mother's letters, to hear what was happening in Youngstown. And they wanted to know, you know, I was wondering why, you know, why were they so fond of Coyote? And they were wondering, why were the people in Youngstown so fond of the mafia? Because it was a really important center for mafia activity. We were halfway between Cleveland and Pittsburgh and halfway between New York and Chicago. And whoever controlled the center really had a lot of power. So at that point, they were in control of the mayor's office, the sheriff's office, the coroner, the county commissioner, the district attorney. So it was a real mafia place. And the Paiutes were saying to me, why, you know, first of all, why have you come out here when we're such dull people and you know, you could be there in such an interesting place? But they also wanted to know, why were people in Youngstown tolerant of this? In fact, even had a sneaking admiration.
You must have begun to see this as time went on, with the Paiutes' interest in that. And then in some ways your history came to meet you in the West, didn't it? You were actually suspected of murder during your field work?
Yes, but it wasn't because I came from a mafia town. What happened was an elderly Paiute man, not a local, but a drifter, was found dead on the outskirts of the community, and he probably had TB. He was an alcoholic. He had fallen down a lot. He had a lot of bruises. But some young children had been seen kicking him earlier in the day. And so a policeman called the children in, and they said they were with me. So I was called in, and I said, yes, in fact, I had notes to prove that they were with me. And the minute he heard about the notes, he got very interested. He released the kids, but he then took in a young man whom I had befriended, a young white boy who hung around the Indians all the time. He was a lonely, forlorn kind of character. And the policeman actually took him in for other reasons entirely. But he then demanded my notes because he actually wanted to, it would have suited him to prove that the boy was not with me, just as unlike the little kids.
And it's almost as though Coyote enters the picture at this point, isn't it? Because you went home for the notes and they weren't there.
They weren't there. That's right. They weren't there. Actually, I'd simply lost them. I'd lost about three pages. And there was a paragraph in there that accounted for my movements at that time. The boy was released soon after that. I got my notes back. Incidentally, this is a thing an anthropologist should never, ever do, is lose your notes. But it happened. And I found that my notes, they didn't 100% exonerate him, but I knew him, and I was quite happy about that. That was the closest I came. I was suspected as an accomplice to murder rather than actually, you know, murder one.
I have the feeling that though this was not a very long time in chronological terms, 3 months, that your time with the Paiutes has stayed with you, kind of a lifelong lesson.
It did. It taught me that what you really need to do is not do research on people, but do it with them. Do it in a participatory way. My perspective matters, but their perspective matters as well. I felt very bad about working with the Paiutes and simply taking from them and not leaving anything with them. And I also felt bad about just presenting them from my perspective.
Is that what trickster and anthropological memoir is about, in a way, giving something at last to the Paiute?
At last. And I'll tell you, a very moving thing in my last visit was I went to the tribal council meeting. The tribal historian, Marlon Thompson, took me over to a tribal council meeting. I had had to go to one in 1964 to explain what I was doing, and now here I was back again going to another one explaining what I was doing. But I looked around the table, and I recognized the faces. They were the grandchildren of the people in my book, the models for the people in my book. And they were the grandchildren of the people in the old tribal council meeting that I had attended. And their names all around the table were the same names that I recognized. And I was so moved by that. And they were moved too. And they were saying to me, did you know my grandfather? Did you ever meet my grandmother? I never met my grandmother, but I wondered, did you talk to her? And it was just so moving to me. They're lovely people.
Eileen Kane is the author of Trickster, an anthropological memoir.
If we could learn to code reality or stimuli the way a shaman does, perhaps we could elongate our range of what we call real.
That's the voice of Carlos Castaneda from a 1968 radio interview. During his lifetime, Castaneda's books about his fantastic spiritual experiences sold at least 10 million copies. But it appears that Castaneda's anthropological bestsellers contain more fiction than fact. Robert Marshall wrote a story called The Dark Legacy of Carlos Castaneda for Salon.com. In the story, Marshall describes Castaneda as the 20th century's most successful literary trickster. Marshall told Anne Strangechamps about Castaneda's first book, The Teachings of Don Juan, A Yaqui Way of Knowledge.
He wrote it when he was still a graduate student at UCLA. It was published in spring of 68, and it's supposedly about a young anthropologist who goes down to the Arizona-Mexico border and meets a shaman named Don Juan, who introduces him to Jimson weed and psychedelic mushrooms and peyote and reveals all kinds of knowledge that supposedly had never before been revealed to any Westerner.
And Castaneda developed all kinds of powers through Don Juan's teachings,
oh,
didn't he?
Oh, yes. He was able to fly. He learned to see like a crow sees. He was able to start a car automatically just using his mind. But I think that's in the second book. Actually, he becomes able to, you know, leap, you know, many, many miles in one moment. So, yeah, there's a lot of magic in it, magic and philosophy.
Now, I remember reading Castaneda's books when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for a suburban 16-year-old, the teachings of Don Juan was pretty mind-blowing stuff.
Right,
but a lot of people felt that way at the time.
Oh, absolutely. There was really just absolutely universal acclaim for those books, at least in the press, there was, in the reviews that he got, and not entirely within anthropology, but many people, you know, were completely blown away by those books.
He became kind of an international celebrity for a while, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. He was one of the most, he may well have been the best-selling author of the 1970s, as it turns out, although those statistics are impossible to be precise with, but he made himself very, very mysterious, and that just added to the aura, and he was on the cover of Time magazine, and he was huge.
Hmm. Now, this was all before the Vision Quest became a kind of New Age cottage industry.
Right.
So for a lot of readers, this was their first encounter with Native American shamanism, and Castaneda presented all of this as truthful.
Absolutely. Throughout his life, he never, you know, would acknowledge that there was anything in it that was anything less than, you know, the absolute, direct, straightforward truth. You know, he said, I can't make anything up. I don't have enough imagination to make anything up. Yeah.
And then he presented himself as a serious anthropologist doing serious, you know, if not quite legitimate anthropological research.
And they were published as such, and they still... Well, the first four books were really taken as such. After that, by the mid to late 70s, there began to be some, you know, the books became more outlandish. There began to be criticism. And, you know, at this point, there's still a few anthropologists who will defend him, but very few. And, you know, they were published and still are published as nonfiction.
Hmm. So how did the whole kind of unmasking or the revelation of this as an elaborate literary hoax come about? For a long time, you said people assumed, even anthropologists and book critics assumed that this was all serious anthropological research and that Castaneda was describing things that actually happened to him.
The first person to kind of make a crack in it was Joyce Carol Oates, who in December 1972 letter to the editor of the Times said, wait a minute, these books just seem like novels to me. And then, you know, more people, you know, began to question them. That spring, Time magazine did something of an expose that showed that It didn't disprove Don Juan, but it showed that everything that he had said about his personal past, that he had been born in Brazil, was the nephew of the ex-president, you know, that he had gone to art school in Milan, that he had been in the army, that all of that was a complete fabrication.
How did Castaneda respond to some of these charges?
Well, once the, you know, people began to question him like that, he began to simply not give interviews, which he was very smart about, as opposed to some other hoaxers who, you know, just put themselves out there to be destroyed. He refused to allow himself to be tape recorded. He refused to allow himself to be photographed. And, you know, basically, you know, the thing was to dismiss any kind of criticism like that as, oh, that's just rational Western thinking, and, you know, they're not willing to make the leap that I have made.
Well, you write that no one contributed more to Castaneda's debunking than Richard DeMille, who wrote a bunch of exposés about him. What evidence did DeMille come up with that the books are hoaxes?
Well, he divided the evidence up into three categories. The one he considered most important were the internal inconsistencies with the books. In other words, you know, Castaneda would, in one book, say he was in this place at a certain time, and in another book, or a book after that, completely contradict that. There's evidence that's a little bit easier to understand, which is simply that Don Juan was supposedly a Yaqui shaman, and the Yaqui do not use peyote in their ceremonial observances. They don't use mushrooms. He got pretty much, you know, everything wrong about the just the kind of observations of the flora, the fauna, the local environment. I shouldn't say he got everything wrong, but he made plenty of mistakes about that.
Well, let's talk about the rest of his life. After the books,
sure.
You uncovered some fascinating details, I guess, after he retired from public view in 1973.
Right.
It's not just that his books became cultish. He literally created a cult of his own.
Yeah, that is what many, you know, this gets a little touchy, but what many people believe. He began to gather a group of women around him, and this goes back really as early as the 60s, who changed their names. And, you know, not all of them did this, but some of them cut off all of their ties to their families and lived either with him or in houses in very close proximity to him.
You said he had this group of extremely devoted young women. There were three in particular, these young women who were known as the witches?
There were three witches. They'd started out being the winds, and there were four winds. That gets into quite a long tale, but the winds morphed into witches. The witches included Florinda, a woman named Taisha Abelar, a woman named Carol Tiggs. After Castaneda died in the spring of 1998 from liver disease and other factors, two of the witches, along with three other women, one of whom was his adopted daughter, you know, and also his lover, Nuri Alexander, disappeared. And, you know, some years ago, Nuri's remains were found in Death Valley, and it took a while to identify them. But the other four, you know, as far as most people are concerned, are missing, although there's still an organization that promotes Castaneda's teachings, and they, you know, I haven't checked their website in quite some time, but, you know, have been asserting that these women are just traveling.
Psychically, I guess.
Traveling. Oh, I don't know. In some other dimension, you know, supposedly they're, you know, giving instructions from afar. But, you know, there are certainly some members of their families who would like to get some information from Clear Green, which is the group that promotes the teachings. And they've not been willing to be cooperative with that.
But as far as anybody knows, these women disappeared after Castaneda's death and haven't been heard from since. Are people suspicious that they committed suicide or were killed?
Yeah, they are. I don't think there's anyone. Who knows? I mean, I haven't heard anyone say that they were killed. But Castaneda frequently spoke about suicide or spoke about taking the leap, you know, going with him, various, you know, metaphors that could be interpreted in different ways. And there's a very widespread belief, at least among many of his followers, that the other four women committed suicide.
Don't you wish you'd met him?
I don't know. you know, perhaps. I'm a little bit, I feel like I've read enough about it and talked to so many people now that, you know, I almost feel that I have. So I'm not sure about that. I also know enough about the damage that, how powerful he was and the damage that happened to people, you know, around him. So
maybe better to keep your distance.
Yeah. That's where I'm at least. But, you know, he was very funny, too. He was super, super, super entertaining. So maybe to have met him once would have been, you know, quite great. But I would have wanted to cut it off there.
Robert Marshall is the author of the Salon.com story, The Dark Legacy of Carlos Castaneda. Marshall's also the author of the novel, A Separate Reality, in which Castaneda plays a background role. He spoke with Anne Strainchamps. And this is music from Sorcerer, a concept album by Michael Stearns and Ron Sunsinger. The album was inspired by Castaneda's work. Have you read any of Carlos Castaneda's books? What'd you think of them? Has the unmasking of Castaneda changed the impact the books have had on you? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to our Facebook page. Coming up, we'll explore the work of the trickster filmmaking brothers, Ethan and Joel Coen, as we conclude our Hour on Trickster. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Erika Rowell has worked in the movie industry and as a journalist. She's the author of The Brothers Grimm, the films of Ethan and Joel Coen. In the book, Rowell describes the Coens as prankster mythmakers. She told Steve Paulson about her fascination with the Coen brothers' movies.
I believe the fascination started with their use of narrative. Originally, I thought, well, I'll watch a Coen brothers movie and things look so familiar and yet so different. And I wanted to see what they were doing to make seeming opposites coexist in their stories, in their movies. And so I started from that perspective, and I was just drawn, you know, the more you look at a Coen brothers movie, the more you find in it. I also liked their playful, and yes, as I say in my book, even trickster mentality that they bring to their storytelling.
Well, in the introduction to your book, you compare Ethan and Joel Coen to the West African trickster god Eshu. What's the connection there?
Right. I think I bring in the story where Eshu wears a multicolored hat or a bicolored hat, and so that one person sees one color, I think it's red, and another villager sees the other color, and they get into an argument because they've both seen this person walking through, this Eshu character, but each is certain of what he's seen. I think that's what the Coen brothers do. They give us a world where conflicting actualities can coexist. In that way, they bring the viewer into the job of interpreting, you know, what they're seeing, making sense of a world that strange dualities or even multiplicities are existing, often at odds with each other.
So are they always playing with point of view? I mean, sometimes we're seeing this through the eyes of one particular character, but maybe we can't really trust what that character is thinking?
I think we see a lot of points of view, certainly in Barton Fink. They play with objective and subjective points of view and kind of blend the two, even in the way the camera is telling the story, so that Barton sometimes walks into his own point of view shot. Not quite muddling them, but certainly playing a little bit with the grammar rules of film.
Now, you mentioned one of the Coen brothers' earliest films, Barton Fink, which was made back in 1991, the story of a New York playwright who goes to Hollywood in the 1940s, where he experiences a terrible writer's block, among other things. And this really plays with the sense of what's real and what isn't, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's this movie that it's very surreal. I think they're drawing a lot on what the surrealist artists, you know, helped create in terms of that art. It's very difficult in that movie, and you could say in a number of Coen brothers movies, it's difficult to see where the reality of the movie, the reality of the fiction begins, and then sort of a strange other world, like a dream world, say, as is the case in Barton Fink. In narratives, we're used to seeing much clearer markers of these different layers of a narrative. They tend to blend one into the other. So as I say in the book, when we watch Barton Fink, our viewing experience becomes a little bit like Barton's own experience, where he can't quite make sense of the world that he's seeing. It's a very strange world, you know, so much so that by the apocalyptic end, he walks into a burning hotel. The next door neighbor, who seemed to be throughout just a regular old Joe, a common man, has turned out to be this madman munt, this killer. And he just walks in without a second thought into a burning room, as if he's just going back into his hotel room where he happens to live. So these layers of reality are very difficult to discern what exactly is going on. And that certainly is the realm of Trickster.
There are all these jokes as part of the movie. For instance, Barton Fink is plagued by a mosquito, but then at one point a character tells him that, you know, Los Angeles was really too dry for mosquitoes in the 1940s.
What the hell happened to your face?
Nothing, it's just a mosquito bite.
Yeah, like hell it is. You know, mosquitoes in Los Angeles, mosquitoes breed in swamps. This is a desert.
So, you know, is this real or not?
Well, exactly, and I think the Coen brothers do this in several of their movies, playing with the idea of knowledge and belief. It really looks like something's biting his face. We've kind of been with him there at night when he's woken up by the hum of a mosquito. I point out in my book that the screenplay can somewhat do this a little more clearly, which is kind of cheating when you're watching a movie, I suppose, if you talk about the screenplay. They say a hum, perhaps a mosquito, is heard. And so right there in the prose, as they put this on camera, we get the idea of it's something very familiar. Maybe we're 90% we know what it is because we recognize that hum. And then we have this fact coming up later on. Well, right, it was a desert. How can there be mosquitoes in the desert?
So it's possible that Barton Fink is crazy.
It's possible that he's crazy. It's possible that he's dreaming. What I argue is that we're seeing a lot of what we see in California is sort of an outpouring of the contents of his head. So we are actually in the writer's head, and it's very unclear, I think, to most viewers exactly, you know, when reality stops and when we start to just see the inner workings of his mind. You know, the life of the mind, that's another kind of in-joke. Not an in-joke, but it's a joke, right? I'll show you the life of the mind, says Charlie Meadows. Well, that's what the movie's been showing us. They're showing us the life of Barton Fink's mind. And if we take everything at face value and try to make sense of this strange world that doesn't really quite exist within the same, you know, physics and parameters as the world that we, the viewers, walk around in, well, then we start to see that, in fact, maybe he doesn't have writer's block. Maybe all of this stuff is churning in his mind, and we're seeing the creative process at work. Hmm. That's basically my main interpretation, I suppose.
I gotta tell you, the life of the mind, there's no roadmap for that territory. And exploring it can be painful. The kind of pain most people don't know anything about.
You mentioned that the Coen brothers often play with our preconceptions about knowledge and belief, and certainly that comes into their later movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, their big hit from 2000. Can you give us a brief summary of that movie?
Sure. Well, in that movie, which opens with a nod to Homer and Homer's Odyssey, we find a group of escape cons, Everett Ulysses McGill being the main partner in crime of the three convicts.
He's the guy played by George Clooney.
Exactly. So he and two of his fellow chain gang convicts, at the very beginning, escape. And purportedly, they escape because one of them has stolen a lot of money, and that money is buried somewhere. And that somewhere where it's buried, the valley that it's buried in, which is close to where Everett is from, is going to be flooded. It's going to be flooded because they're going to light up the South. They're going to bring electricity to that little part of Mississippi. And they have all these adventures along the way, not unlike the more famed traveler, Ulysses, a.k.a. Odysseus.
Mm-hmm. And there are all these allusions to Homer's Odysseus. Obviously, starting with the name of the George Clooney character, Ulysses.
Right.
And he sort of has this circuitous way of getting back to his wife, who's being courted by a suitor and has to win her back through trickery in a way. They must have had fun sort of going back and, you know, trying to create a cinematic version of this ancient epic.
Oh, they must have had a blast. I think it's using the Homeric story, which celebrated Ulysses' character, the Odysseus character. And when the Coen brothers take it, they make the Everett character, who's very much a trickster character. He's a liar. He's a thief. He brings about radical change. He takes us from one world of corruption, political corruption, and strangely, through his song, through almost not happenstance, but through a bizarre series of events, he affects this social change and brings a better world order. Even after sort of a water apocalypse, when the flood actually comes into the valley and kind of saves them through this strange kind of water rebirth, you know, in the end, the poser who's been trying to become elected doesn't get elected, and instead, the Charles Durning character does get elected. He's the incumbent, but he brings into his fold now the three cons that we've been following throughout.
So the cons become the truth tellers in a way.
Absolutely, yes. The liars become the truth tellers. They lie to get us to a higher truth.
Well, and to some degree, this is the dichotomy that comes up in a lot of Coen Brothers movies. On the one hand, they are full of playfulness, sort of this trickster element we've been talking about, and yet some of them deal with very serious issues. I mean, Oh Brother, racism and injustice in the South.
Absolutely. I mean, I was blown away by the boldness of this movie. In that they're taking on such, and this was before Barack Obama was elected president, they're always sort of ahead of these main cultural streams. And the fact that they talked about something we don't often talk about, you know, in our general everyday lives, you know, like the history of racism. I mean, the Ku Klux Klan scene is a haunting scene.
Erica Rowell is the author of The Brothers Grimm, the films of Ethan and Joel Coen. She spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 912A, Trickster. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.